happy place.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And count to 5, it's pretty good to be alive. Make that it's great to be alive. When you play in Records with John.
Hello, all you lucky listeners out there in earbud land, and thank you for listening to Playing Records with John. I'm your host, John. Now, on this episode, I will be sitting down with my old friend Brad Armstrong. Maybe you know him as one of the voices in 13 Ghosts, a terrific band out of my hometown of Birmingham, Alabama. Now, I did mention that we're old friends because this conversation you're about to hear is the kind of conversation we might have had anyway. The only difference was this time I insisted on bringing microphones and we were going to record it, regardless of how awkward that might be. The other thing was I had, with very short notice, had asked Brad to create a playlist of his own music, going back as far as he wanted to go, that we would listen to in chronological order and hopefully bring us forward to the present day and use that as the springboard for whatever we would talk about. And he was game. I think the text conversation went something like, "Hey, Brad, I'm going to be in town. You want to hang out tonight?" And he was like, "Sure, dude." And then I said, "Do you mind if we record it?" And he was like, "Sure, whatever." And then I said, "Can you make a playlist of your music?" And he said, "Oh, okay." And because of that, you get this, the musical history of Brad Armstrong. Hey, Brad.
Hey, John.
Thanks for doing the show.
I'm delighted to be here.
And today we're going to be talking about your musical history through some of the recordings you've selected. Can you turn that thing here?
Oh, yeah, I thought I did.
The cricket machine?
I thought I turned the cricket machine off. That's not. That's actually just. That's actually just my audience.
Right.
As it turns out, I haven't heard any of these since probably around the time that I made them. So
we discussed this via text like a few hours ago.
That's right.
And now we're doing it. So you didn't have much time to pull this list.
No, almost no time, John.
So
almost
I think
no time.
You expressed the thought that you had chosen some songs that are kind of embarrassing or could be embarrassing.
They could, and it's likely they are because I mean they were done in the vicinity of 15 or 20 years ago or something.
Drink a glass of wine at 5 a.m. Got the culture down in time to watch the dawn rise. Wake the neighbors with the sound of breaking glass as you throw Merlot up against their wall. It's too late to be somebody you tell yourself you're already 23. Your hands held cup to hummingbirds cradled in the folio lab. Don't know which way to go, whether they're flying up or down. Don't make much difference. If you cry, don't make a sound. Don't make much difference if she does not come around anymore.
Something else.
We really laughed at your songwriting.
Yes.
When the protagonist of the song seemed to be saying that he was already 23.
Sans irony. Also, I think it's pretty great that obviously I had just recently learned what Merlot was, apparently, and the idea of dashing a glass of Merlot against a wall because of your rage at being already the washed up old age of 23 is quite a lovely image, I think. I love the fact that I was really trying super hard to make my voice sound like a person who's been smoking for 30 years and is a old, very world traveled and weary person.
And now you can do that with no effort
now
at all.
Now I can't fail to do it. Yeah. I remembered that now when I was listening to it. I was like, I used to really try to make my voice sound like that on purpose and everything.
I mean, you wouldn't be the first person to kind of put on a voice, but did you ever feel like it was a put on, or did you feel like you were doing a character?
I felt like everybody else was putting that voice on and that I was somehow authentic in my delivery of it because I was, of course, already 23. And so I had earned that voice, John. So,
so where would you describe that voice coming from? Like, what do you
think? Tom Waits. I remember discovering Rain Dogs when I was, my friend in college showed it to me when I was probably 18 or something.
And, he showed it to you, and then a couple of months later, he played it for you.
He played it for me. And I heard that Gun Street Girl or whatever it's called.
Fell in love with my name named Tahuma. Dig around till it's all tale.
And it had the banjo and everything. It was just that and a drum or something. And I remember being floored by it because I had, previously been listening to Van Halen and Led Zeppelin and stuff. And I was unaware that there was a way to make heavy rock and roll music that didn't involve an electric guitar.
How does it feel at the ripe old age of, what, 38?
39.
To listen to the ramblings of a 23-year-old who decides that you could take three totally different songs and make them one song.
And, it was really quite an interlude. I want to point that out. That was some feedback interlude.
So who all was playing on that? It was you playing all the instruments except for drums?
Yeah, it was just me and Mikey.
So Mikey D. Williams.
That's right.
We both sort of were cheering Mikey D on when that instrumental breakdown.
Yes. Yeah, that was he was quite a drummer. Quite a solid drummer. Still is, of course.
You were kind of chuckling when you started listening to it. Do you think that
it's awkward.
Does it feel overworked or does it feel...
It's like watching yourself on a home video or something from when you were 17 and you're full of bravado and you're showing your ass and you're trying to be loud and funny and my thing on watching all those old movies of myself is that I was always kind of an asshole, and I was really not even just totally an asshole, and would just be being blatantly mean or rude to people. And at the time, I really remember thinking, "This is hilarious. I am killing."
I will deliberately play the asshole or the boob,
right,
or the guy who's a little slow-witted, because to me, it's funny. It gives you a different edge. But I find that if you do that too much, people begin to think you're an asshole and a boob.
And I really thought I was having a very different effect on people than I actually was. And I think that that could also be said for the song that we just heard.
Yeah.
I have no question that the effect that I thought I was having had bore very little relationship with what was actually going on. Yeah, man.
The king of
fills.
Spectacular.
I mean, that's really a great drumming. It's a shame, honestly, that I couldn't just leave the vocal track completely off that. And let it,
the reason I was glad you were playing another one of the four-track songs is because, that is a good drum sound.
That is
a great
drum sound.
Primarily good. A lot of it has to do with tape. But what I remember back in the day, because this was around the same time, 97, 98.
Yeah.
And Lewis was around.
Yes.
And you guys were kind of working together. I remember at the time, you guys bragging about the drum sound you were getting. And And I don't remember thinking...
Because we were always so modest, John.
No, let me finish. But I don't remember thinking people. That sounded that important to me. And I was like, oh, whatever. Let's just record some songs, you know?
Right.
But I hear that now, and I realize you did. That was a good drum sound. That's do you remember what the breakthrough was?
Here it is.
Drum sound.
Ready? 100% of the drum sound is created by the drummer. That's it. That's the magic formula for getting an awesome drum sound. Is a drummer that understands physically how to hit the drums hard and the cymbals quiet.
It's like a catalog of references. It's right. There's definitely a 50 Ways to Leave Your Lover thing going on. And then two of us thing at the end.
Yes,
and
we used to call it 50 Ways to Leave Your Blackbird. That's how we referred to it. I want to say that song that Cobain had just done the unplugged thing and the Lead Belly thing, my girl thing, and I wanted to do something that had that sort of resonance to it. I remember because I was probably 19 or 20 or something.
Thank you. anything, then you are in your most dangerous position.
Is that real thunder and rain? Or were you beating a piece of sheet metal?
You know, what's great about that is that I remember I had this, wait, what was it? It was like I was taking this Worlds of Music class, and you had to buy this like $60 six CD collection or something to take the class that had all this random shit on it. Like, it'd be like, you know, post workers from Malaysia stamping the envelopes in unison. It'd be 45 seconds of, you know, whatever. And I think that came from that somehow. Okay. Or else I just went to the library and checked out sound effects. It was before the interweb, as it were.
So that was, we've discovered while we were listening to that song.
Yes.
A bit of timeline confusion.
Yeah, yeah.
That song was actually recorded when you were a student at Sarah Lawrence.
Right, which
before
was...
Before you recorded the songs on the four-track in Andrew's basement.
Right. They had a real studio up there, good 8-track in it, and a real board, and you know, and you had to take the class and you know, learn how to patch sounds in the Moog or whatever, and you know, everything was from scratch and everything, so it was a good class to have taken, and so that was when I started screwing around with production and stuff the first
time. Did you say, was it a production class, or was it a...
Yeah, it was like studio production, or studio recording, they called it electronic studio. Because it was still, you know, the 1970s at Sarah Lawrence when this newfangled electronic studio thing had just come out.
So you were using the 1970s electronic studio in,
it was all
what,
this great
95,
gear.
94
okay. was when I think I did that, thereabouts. Right. The gear that was in that place at the time, we just didn't give a shit about it, man. Mm-hmm. It was whatever. And it is probably worth a lot of money now if you could get it back. The studio was in the basement of this old mansion up there, and you could get in crazily. They would take you over there and turn you loose in the middle of this mansion with all this shit in it, like alone at 3 a.m. as a, you know, 19-year-old drug addict or something. They would just cut you loose in this house with all this really nice ornate stuff and pianos, and I could have gone in there and gone crazy and with a can of spray paint or something, and they just would turn you loose. So we went in there. I went in there, and I was alone doing it and stuff. And it was really freaky and weird and kind of creepy and stuff. But I remember getting the radio sounds. The point is that the radio sounds, I recorded all of it in one night, and I did all the stuff. And then I wanted to do some radio stuff because I had listened to Wish You Were Here, you know, every day for the last 2 years or something, and was just all up in that world of production. And so I turned the little clock radio that I brought down from my room, and I turned it on and stuff, and then just did the song live, you know? Like, what you hear is me standing there for the duration of the playback with the thing, just tuning randomly through stations and stuff. And I hit that religious stuff at the end completely, like, insane. There was no trickery there. It was all going to half-inch tape and stuff, and there wasn't any, like, you know, I didn't splice it in later or whatever. So,
wait, Brad, there weren't any waveforms you could drag
there
around.
Were no waveforms that I was dragging in.
What was the interface like?
So it happened just that way. And I remember when I was just listening to it, and it got to that end, it's like, and there was no desire for God, no desire for salvation or whatever. And then I remember standing there listening to it going like, I knew he was going to hit a point and have a great stop. And I had my finger on the tuning knob for the second that he was going to stop the sentence so that I could get off of it and make a clean edit. And he hit the thing that I forgot what he said now already, but he hit whatever the last thing was, you know, and I immediately threw the tuning knob off with my thumb and then threw the thing on the ground and broke it. My fucking radio.
It was your own radio.
Yeah, I broke it.
This didn't belong to Electronic
Studio.
Time,
no. And at the time, I felt like it was worth it.
Small macro sits in the fridge. Ate stale beer nuts until I was sick.
This one, I will tell you, my teacher at Sarah Lawrence, who I'm pretty sure just thought I was the sort of useless guy in the class and just had no future in music whatsoever. And, gee, was he ever wrong or what? And
Who knew? Who knew then that you'd be sitting in your own garden shed talking into a microphone about your career?
Oh yes. I finished playing it for the class, and he said, "Well, let's go make $1 million." And I remember at the time being sort of like, "Wow, he thinks this song's great, and that, you know, that maybe I finally have hit on something that he's." And then, of course, I came to realize, you know, not too long after that, oh, he was being totally cynical and sardonic and making a remark about how shitty and commercial and derivative my thing was. And I really feel like I probably felt like I was doing like a Raymond Carver slice of life level of quality when I came up with Simon and Simon, you know, sitting around in front of the TV watching Simon and Simon. I really felt like that was Carver-esque. I mean, that,
but don't
was,
you think
that
being,
was quality
don't
work.
Don't you think if you were a 19-year-old and you even knew what Carver-esque no, meant, that you were already a little bit ahead of the game? So was that your college experience? I mean, was that kind of wrapped up in this?
I mean, yeah. I remember that song was written about the house that we all shared in, and you know, me and my five roommates. you may have seen it. It was on a little show called The Real World.
Is it what happens when people stop being nice and start being real?
We started being.
That's
real.
What happens. That song.
Yeah, that's exactly what happens.
We should start being nice again. So we've discovered that initially,
wow,
in this batch of songs, your vocals were influenced by Tom Waits.
And
next up, it was Kurt Cobain or Lead Belly by way of Kurt Cobain.
Yep.
But lately, we've discovered that at this period, you were being influenced by Eric Cartman. These songs sound cool, though. I mean, I remember when I first heard these songs, thinking that they sounded cool. And not to be too inside with this, but I remember hearing these songs shortly around the time that you were recording them, and it was exciting to hear somebody make like personal music that was big, and it was just
terrible. It's just
terrible. So you don't like this stuff?
Oh, it's awful. It's the worst. It's the worst. I mean, the voice is literally, I feel like it is literally like a saw blade on my ear. I mean, it just is torture to listen to it. Thank you.
never dream of you anymore.
So where was that recorded?
I think I want to say it was definitely the front end of 13 Ghosts.
So that was at Andrew's house.
Yeah,
Otterworks. What would we call that studio?
Otterworks,
owned by Andrew Vernon. What was this project? Because I almost feel like we hear this, I feel like you're hearing the voice that you tend to sing with most naturally now on this song. Like it seems like a pretty stark shift from the other stuff we were listening to.
Like, yeah, this is late. This is probably around. I want to say this is probably around 2001 or something like that. Maybe 2000, something like that. And that the reason I selected that one was because I remember it was right around the time that Bonnie Prince Billy record came out. Mm-hmm. That I See a Darkness record. Did you get into that one at all?
I remember that everyone was playing that record, and
you never got it. So you were basically an unhip, total loser, failed guy that didn't have it. It was Bonnie Prince Billy and Neutral Milk Hotel for lunch. Yeah. It was delicious.
Yeah.
It was a delicious, nutritious day of music listening.
I think that when the harmony kicked in on that one, it was when I really noticed how relaxed the vocals sounded.
And it's just me, and Andrew played drums on it. And I did all the stuff and sang to myself, so I don't know if I played the bass or not. Sammy may have played the bass. I don't remember if he did or not. But
Sammy Boggin, who was later or at that time already, was he already playing with 13 Ghosts?
No, I don't think he was. That's the thing. Mm-hmm. I think he just had to be around or something, and that was the sort of precursor of him getting in the band.
Yeah.
Was he would stop in and play on some cuts.
So 13 Ghosts was a going concern then at that point.
It's a little fuzzy because I feel like, I don't know why Buzz wasn't involved in this recording, but he wasn't. And it seems odd because it seems like we started working together in 98 or something like that, and right around the funeral thing, and I don't know when I did this is the point.
Yeah.
So, but it was somewhere around there, and it seemed like an eye-opening experience to me somehow.
The funeral thing, I don't know that we can completely just...
I don't know if we should...
Put an ellipsis for that. Well, I wouldn't want to go for it, but I would just say that like the formation of the band... was sort of stemmed from a former bandmate of yours and Buzz's and Mikey's,
right?
Who had committed suicide.
Yes,
there was something kind of death obsessed about that band from the very beginning.
As it turns out, all of the material that I write now is pretty much about the same thing. Strange that one doesn't really get away from one subject matter.
You don't find that as you get closer to death, you write less about death?
You know, it's pretty weird. I mean, really, if you think about that, I don't know if, I mean, what, you know, I remember the Harry Met Sally movie and...
Not the book.
the
pinball
Billy,
machine.
Billy Crystal, I don't know, and he was talking about death, and it was supposed to be a big mockery of all the kids in the college are obsessed with death, and he wants to read the last page of the book before he... dies, you know, so that he can know how it comes out in case he dies. Remember all that shit? Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, I really had the idea that I might grow out of this or something. Right. Yeah, but no, as it turns out, not at all. It turns out I'm just going to keep writing about it.
Well, I mean, what else is there to write? I mean, that sounds like a stupid thing to say, but what else is there to write about?
Well,
like,
that's been my argument for years.
But I mean, would you say that when you get into that stuff, does it feel to you like it's autobiographical, or do you feel like you're kind of writing stories and creating characters and...
Stories and characters, mostly, I think. Mm-hmm. I mean, of course, autobiographical creeps into it, but mostly not. Mostly I'm not very interested in my own life. I've never really have been. You know what I mean? It's not very interesting.
You seem concerned with your own death and nothing else.
I'm going to miss this old life.
Welcome to the rest home. We hope you find it nice here. Down. We know this isn't easy.
You seemed to cringe less listening to that song.
No, it was still pretty cringy.
So the completely still in your chair, staring at the speakers, was sort of a, like a deer in the headlights kind of thing.
That's a function of it being 2:30 in the morning. So I just don't have any energy left to move.
At this point, that was Golden Years from Your Window Is Burning, right?
That's right.
And that was your first sort of official CD with 13 Ghosts. And at that time, the lineup was Mikey D on drums, Sammy Boggan on bass.
That's right. Buzz Russell on other songs and guitar.
Yeah. And then Andrew was sort of co-producing and co-engineering and, you know, all that stuff.
Right.
At the time. So, you know, we just had talked about the sort of death obsession in that song. It's kind of it's right there on the surface.
Well, you know, my grandmother, she used to say, these people come in here and say, talking about how great the golden years are, and they call them your golden years. There's nothing golden about these years. These years are terrible. I hate these years, she used to say. So I got to thinking about golden years and all that stuff.
Well, I always thought of it as like a retirement home for like prematurely jaded rock guys.
It was supposed to be a totally genuine old person. But cynically, of course, you're suggesting that they maybe they can convince their grandchildren to bring them methods to kill themselves.
Yeah.
You know, so obviously it was not a cheery, upbeat, you know.
It wasn't like Cocoon. It wasn't like an uplifting story.
You know, and also what I remember about this is that the Strokes had a 3-song EP floating around. They had that whole preamp distorted vocal thing going on. Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we jumped right on that goddamn bandwagon, didn't we? Wow, that's great. So really what you can learn, I think, from this whole podcast is basically that I just rip everybody off. That's how I think everybody does that, I feel like. I mean,
was that song a conscious effort to sort of marry a really grim lyric to a jaunty song?
Yes. Although, I remembered it being a lot faster than that. This was the song I remember making like a conscious effort of like, I've got to stop this Tom Waits depressing, slow, easy, like piano-y or acoustic-y or whatever. We got to cut that shit out, and we've got to bring some rock and roll to the table and jump on the Strokes bandwagon, because we have got to, that's what the people want. You got to deliver what the people want. And so
you
got
to catch up with those 20-year-old New York hipsters by writing a song about being 80.
Well, that's what the fucking comedy is. That's what I love. It's so great, because listen to this shit. I really thought that was like, at the time, I really thought it was like this sort of like snappy, upbeat, sort of edgy punks. It's just another fucking dirge.
Look in the garden, my dear. Shade trees have grown some this year. And all of the children we raised have left us for others. Milkman don't come anymore. Or didn't you notice how thirsty you are? tell you how happy I am to be in this old house with you. The broken down roof lets a pretty light. Don't you think all that sunshine is nice? And all of these fingers of mine reaching up out toward the full open sky.
That's off the album Cicada, which came out in 2004. That's what I was about to say, after two and three.
I think it was four.
And that was a huge album. I mean, literally a huge album. It had like 22 songs on it or something.
Yes, it was a ginormous album.
Well, I remember even in that soup of great songs, that song really stood out to me as just weirdly pretty. And I think that the harmony, you and Buzz singing together, has maybe never sounded better than it does on that song.
Yeah, I think that's true. Generally, before that time, I would write a song and it would be in one sitting. Like, I would get the whole song written in one sitting, even if the lyrics bothered me or something. Mm-hmm. And that one was like, all right, you know, I have a thing here that I want to do. Specifically, and it was the first time I was trying to marry writing and songs. You know, because prior I always looked at lyrics as a different thing than poems or anything. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that was the first time that I sort of realized that that's not supposed to be true. So I tried to put them together, something which means going back to it and rewriting and adding. So I would get a verse and then it would be a week or something. And then I would get another verse. Like, I have to have a melody and some kind of line or two, mm-hmm. or the song is tough to write. You got to have, like, you know, "Look in the Garden, My Dear," was the thing.
And yeah, which then, suggests and then, like a mood and a
character.
Yeah,
and then you got that. And then you slowly, what is in the garden? Where are you looking from and who's looking and all that stuff comes from it. And so you take the time and you write the tune.
But, I mean, that again sounds so much more relaxed. You know,
yeah, well, that was the thing. And less effects too, and no filters and no EQs and no reverbs and stuff. It was just raw. And that was kind of, that's the way I don't know. I guess I go back and forth.
I realize we've gotten this far without really talking much about guitar, when that's kind of your thing.
It's never felt like my thing.
But I mean, you would accept that people think of you as kind of a guitar guy, or that you were brought in as a utility player, as a guitar guy.
Yeah, but I've always felt like, you know, and this is in no way, I swear to God, This is in no way false modesty.
This is completely magnanimous,
completely
admirable
with
modesty.
All humility, yeah. I have to say. I'm serious. With all humility and modesty.
With all the humility that a very honorable man can muster up, and I can muster up quite a bit of humility.
I've never thought of myself as a very good guitar player at all. I've always felt like I was barely holding on and just like.
Well, I think you said in the past to me that you've compared yourself to like a session player, and you don't think you could come in and like just nail it in one take and then go have a cigarette and be gone.
Meaning that I'm not a session player, right?
But I do it.
That's the thing. So that's what's kind of weird. It's like I sort of feel like I've pulled a fast one on everybody.
When did you first pick up a guitar?
I was 8 and my cousin was 9. And this is the cat that killed himself from our previous happy-go-lucky conversation about that. And,
which I very rudely dredged up. I apologize. One more apology.
And he had this guitar, which is hanging on the wall right over there. You see it? That's the guitar he had when he was 9. Mm-hmm. It's an Electra. I think it's a late 70s model, but it might be an early 80s model. I'm not really sure. And he was playing Wild Thing when I met him because my uncle married his mom after his mom got divorced. So I actually met him and he became my not blood cousin. So we became buddies, and he was playing Wild Thing on it with one finger, but with standard tune. So it was just, you know, terrible, of course. But it sounded so great to me, you know. And so that was, so I got a guitar when I borrowed his and played with his and stuff until I was like 10 or 11 or something. And then my mom got me a guitar.
But you guys played together for, I mean, pretty consistently for what, 20 years after that or something?
Well, I guess.
Maybe not 20, 15.
Oh.
Off and on.
Yeah, or something like that. I mean, we had, you know, kind of a falling out and stuff. It was kind of weird, you know. But I guess we made music together and stuff. In fact, the cut that I played first, the 23 Merlot Against the Wall tune, was, I remember playing him that tune. And that was one of the last times we hung out together.
Wow.
And he said, he very genuinely said that he liked it, which was really sort of moving because he really hated everything at that point. Hated it all, just with a hate. A deep, bitter, cynical hatred.
Raise a bottle to the long gone space cadet. He's arrested himself there in the bottom of the glass boat. Sweet William in the belly of the rocket ship. Boosters blasting off. Don't you listen, don't worry.
Heights. They left the apartment for a night. We had just had our first child, and they moved to her parents' apartment for a night or even two nights so that I could record. They got out of there and gave me the apartment as a studio. And so one of the things I did was I
busted down all the walls and you hung blankets everywhere.
I recorded this tune, but not, well, I guess most of it was recorded in New York. I probably re-sang it when I got down here or something mm-hmm. to the studio for the record, but I know I did the guitars up there, and the ambient stuff was a bunch of wine glasses filled up with water and you know, and doing all that business.
The rare crazy idea like that yes. you actually follow through on. I know. And
it
keep
was a bunch of them on the recording. A bunch of them. And then I remember also, like, when we were recording it, I was like, there needs to be like some, like, I wanted like a backwards, like, vacuum door seal thing opening, like the spaceship doors opening or something. And I don't know mm-hmm. what it would be, really, just that it sort of sounds like, you know, and so
I call that the last noodle.
Yes. And so I ended up just going like,
that was on Strangest Colored Lights. Correct?
That's right.
And
yeah.
What was the lineup of the band at that point?
At that point, that was,
Jason Lucia on drums
and Sammy Boggin and Andrew and myself and Buzz.
So was the lineup in flux? I mean, I know later you added another guitarist.
Well, then after this record, it started being in flux.
Here lie the last manuscripts of Carter John Leibowitz, the last living man in the loneliest town, on the desperate border of southwestern Canada. He wrote all his poems in invisible ink and then buried them all in the snow. And when finally Carter John Leibowitz burned up in a passionate fire born of his own convictions, all of his poems were eaten by wandering foxes. They'd been written on the blue skins of 10,000 berries, traced like the features of those children on Kerry, committed to form by a hand which knew nothing of form. So here lie the last manuscripts of Carter John Leibowitz, which no one has read from, which no one can read from again. Now the same could be said of Miss Margaret Turtledove. She sang all the songs she made into a jar. Then she capped them with sealing wax, planked them and screwed them fast. She flung them down in a well and poisoned the aquifer and covered them over with mud. And when Margaret Turtledove had buried the thing she loved, she found there was nothing dug, could never be undug. She poured herself down the hole and mined for her lost jar of song. But the ground was well satisfied, her table was empty, the roots of the hollow trees had filled themselves plenty. The kings of the undersoil had poured all her songs down their throats. And Margaret Turtledove, the last thing she ever sung, a song in a broken key, a tune with no melody, a verse with no words to sing, which no one has ever heard, which no one can ever hear again. Steal down your passageways and hide mirrors on your stage, and everyone is watching as you fall through the floor. But remember what I said to you, the best and only thing you do is disappear. When anyone calls for you, you cut and run. This is the only magic that you know. And you walk through your endless days and gather your bills to pay, and the women that you cower with will never bear your child. And the only way you'll never die is writing songs, poetic lies, anything make your legacy. But the ground will one day open up and swallow you in it. The work you've done is now undone, you never began it. The only thing immortal is the epitaph we'll carve in your stone. Here lie the last manuscripts, the words to the songs unwrit, the poems in it meaningless, the memories of what you did collected in your consciousness. The only thing you ever made, the only thing you ever were, the only thing you'll ever be, which no one has read from, which no one can read from again.
That tune, it's almost like coming full circle in some weird way, because the idea there was to make this raw thing that was going to be real and something you could record with a boombox or something. Mm-hmm. So we set up to do that, and I think Andrew probably had two or three mics or something at various places around the room pointed at me or something, and I was sitting in a chair. And that was it. And I played the tune and got, you know, three quarters of the way through it or something and broke string. Like an A string or something on my acoustic guitar, which is a pretty big, so you can hear me rip the string off, and I just kept going because I was feeling like it was the vibe. I don't know. I was just going to try and go with it and see what happened or something. Mm-hmm. So all that stuff that happens, I didn't plan any of this stuff, and hitting the guitar and doing it with that. I just couldn't figure out how to play the chords I needed to play without the critical string. So I just stopped playing and just did it that way, right? And then when we listen to it, the playback, of course, you know, because of course this is, I mean, it can't be totally selfless or I mean, you have to be in your head somewhat if you're doing that. It can't be completely organic, I don't think. You know, there's some part of you that's aware of what you're doing when you do something like that. Like, well, maybe this will be great.
And then the fact that you don't just say stop,
fuck
when you restring
this and do
this.
It again.
Yeah.
Maybe it'll be cool to have it be even more authentic than it could be. But you're having these thoughts while you're having an authentic experience, so it's kind of weird. And I was incredibly nervous about putting it on the record. I didn't really want to at all, but I was very uncomfortable about how naked it was and how weird it was. And my voice sounds kind of weird. And it was the first time I ever decided, okay, this is something I don't want to do, and it makes me nervous, and I'm scared to put it out, and I think it sounds weird. And it makes me really uncomfortable. And that's the reason that I'm going to do it. Mm-hmm. Like, I wanted to do something that I was fearful about.
Yeah. And that was on The Strangest Colored Lights?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
That's the last song on there, right?
Yeah, it is.
No, I actually remember...
The hidden track.
I actually remember listening to that album on the way home from work. And when I heard that song for the first time, it was one of those times where you're like a minute into the song, but you're already parked. But I remember sitting in the car and listening to the rest of that song, kind of thinking like, what do I do now? That song, you know. You've been working on some stuff here in your, your garden shed.
This is my new stuff.
I don't think about my friends. I haven't seen them in a while, and none of them are my friends anymore. I don't think about my wife. She left me here in Babylon, and I watched her walking out the door with a rifle in her hand. I have lost my way again. No one can survive me here. There's a desert road running through my head, and I'm standing on it. Cloud banks in the distance, hand of God is bearing down. Fata Morgana waits for me, extends to me her ladders. There's a brightly colored storm. Well, there's lightning bolts across my vision. There's a dream that I've been having, where the ground descends upon me like a breaking wave. I can call the wind to me, I can swallow up the sea, and none shall stand before me where I roam. Though time shall pass for others, in my house there are no clocks, for I have no need of marking what I never shall endure.
take your children for my own. I make no vain apology. Mine eyes have seen the glory. Yes, they have. And in the coming apocalypse, I taste your eyes and kiss your lips. We are the walking dead. Our train is long, our numbers growing. There's a brightly colored storm. There's lightning bolts across my vision. There's a dream that I've been having, where the ground descends upon me like a breaking wave.
I'm glad we could end on some uplifting subject matter.
Yes, I wanted to illustrate that.
So is it a dead on, no pun intended, reference to The Walking Dead, or is it just a sort of an ancillary benefit? Is it a zombie analogy or metaphor, or is it actually about zombies?
Well, it is. I like to believe that there is a little bit more going on there than just a straight retelling of a zombie story.
Meaning, the devil, you say.
It's a metaphor, you know. Mm-hmm. I would have to say, although that sounds, I hate saying that something's a metaphor. You know what I mean?
Why not make a metaphor for saying that? Brad, thank you for playing records with me.
Wow, John, thanks for having me, buddy.
Now Billy raised up his fist and took one step forward. Baby, I took two steps back. Not cause I was nervous.
The song you're listening to right now is one of my favorites by 13 Ghosts. It's called Billy D from their album Garland of Bottleflies. That album, along with three others by the band, is available on iTunes for a very affordable price. So go on over there and check them out. You really can't go wrong with any of those. Now, on a slightly more self-promotional note, if you'd like to hear some music that Brad and I did together, try sci-fi.bandcamp.com. That's sighfigh.bandcamp.com. And play the EP The First Pretty Morning. That's a couple of songs that have Brad all over them. As for this podcast, if you have any complaints or requests, or if you want to recommend a band or an album to feature on this show, hit me up at playingrecordswithjohn@gmail.com. That's about it. Let's do this again.
I'm sizing him up. Now the police chief said, hey, wait a minute, boys, we got to have us some rules here. Well, I said, only one rule, chief, and that's the last man standing. Well, then Billy said go, and he staggered over toward me. I could see already how it was with him. So it lay.